the fact that there's this kind of eruption momentary is not surprising.
All right. That's KJ. His article, The Semiotics of Face Slashing in South Korea, is at Counterpunch. We're going to continue this dialogue. There's so much more to say. And we thank you for joining us. I'm Dennis Bernstein. That does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints.
And good morning. You are listening to your community radio station. We are KBOO Portland, just a minute before 11 o'clock on this Thursday morning. In about a half hour, instead of Words and Pictures today, we've dug up an old episode of Sprouts, which is a program distributed by Pacifica Radio. Now, this episode will be featuring excerpts of a panel discussion by people who were personally and professionally close to Malcolm X, as well as scholars of the topic of assassination. Now, this discussion was held in 2009 at the Shabazz Center in Harlem, New York City, a historic site of the assassination of Malcolm X. Panelists describe intimate details and specific circumstances surrounding the assassination of Malcolm X and provide an intriguing look at the method and meaning of assassination in our culture. That is coming up in about a half hour, but first we've got Between the Covers, next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Last Days in Vietnam, a film screening on Thursday, March 19th at Concordia University in Portland. Last Days in Vietnam is a new documentary from Rory Kennedy which examines the final days of American presence in Saigon and the efforts taken to evacuate 135,000 South Vietnamese. Again, that's Last Days in Vietnam, Thursday, March 19th at 6 p.m. at the Hagen Building at Concordia University, 2811 Northeast Holman Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film Occupy the Farm, playing at the Clinton Street Theater Thursday, April 2nd at 6:30 p.m.
Our main concern is water right now.
The university actually shut off our water.
What we're going to be doing is handing buckets over the fence.
Occupy the Farm tells the inspiring story of 200 farmers who occupy the last piece of farmland in California's urban East Bay, planting 15,000 seedlings to feed the community and disrupt plans to build a shopping mall. That's Occupy the Farm, Thursday, April 2nd, 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, my name is Gene Bradley, and you are listening to KBOO Radio, your community radio station at 90.7 on the FM dial, coming to you from Portland, Oregon. Our guest today on Between the Covers is David Troyer, who is joining us to talk about his new novel, Prudence, published by Riverhead Books, which is part of the Penguin Group. Mr. Troyer is a member of the Ojibwe Nation. He spent much of his childhood on the Lake Leech Reservation in northern Minnesota, near the headwaters of the Mississippi River. He graduated from Princeton in 1992 with a degree in anthropology and a PhD from the University of Michigan in 1999, also with anthropology. He's now professor of literature at the University of Southern California, teaching in the Creative Writing and Literature program. He's the author of three previous novels and two works of nonfiction, the latest in 2012 being Res Life, An Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life. David Troyer, welcome to KBOO. Congratulations on your new novel, which is getting sensational reviews.
It's getting fantastic reviews.
It's wonderful.
The kind of coverage and the kind of engagement that you dream of. So it's been perfect.
Well, it's a fantastic novel.
Thank you.
You grew up in the Leech Lake Reservation, part of the Leech Lake Band, an Ojibwe nation. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and your connection with this place?
Sure. You know, my father's not native. He's Jewish. He's an Austrian Jew, actually. And my mother's Ojibwe from Leech Lake, and that's where I was grew up. That's where I grew up. And you know, I suppose I don't know. Most of my father's family was, but not all, but most was killed in the Second World War and by the Germans. So he didn't have much family left after the war. And when he and my mother met, he just became a part of that scene. So Leech Lake was my environment growing up.
And you went to school there, and you and your brothers?
I went to school in Bemidji, which is a town just off the reservation, a very mixed school, lots of Native kids, lots of non-Native kids. And of course, you know, when you're a teenager, you don't really think, at least I didn't think in those terms. I just thought in terms of who's cool and who's not and who's going to beat me up today. and things like that. You just, you know, the life isn't so, you know, defined by our sort of understanding of, you know, maybe race or culture and so on. You're much more enmeshed in the daily business of getting by as a teenager in a small town in the middle of nowhere.
So you went from a small town in the middle of nowhere to Princeton University. Was that the culture shock we imagined?
it sure was. I went there, and the only reason I applied was that my older brother who's 1 year older, he'd applied and gotten in and went. And I did not want anyone to have the wrong idea. I didn't want anyone to, for even a moment, to think that he was in any way smarter than I was, so I had to apply.
Just because he's older doesn't mean
he's better
looking or stronger or anything.
Yeah, none of that's true.
None of that stuff.
And
true.
So, you know, you heard it here, folks, you know. And so I applied.
Hope he's not listening. I mean,
yeah, well, let's hope. He's a good man. But anyway, yeah, I applied and I got in and I went, and it was very much a bit of culture shock. My classmates had gone to schools, you know, prep schools and collegiate and Andover and Deerfield Academy and the like, and were very, very well prepared. And they were kind of fluent in the language of and the games played by the quote unquote meritocracy, right? Which isn't exactly a meritocracy at all.
Right, right.
And they knew the score. They knew the game. And I didn't even know there was a game being played. And so I struggled a lot at first.
But you did remarkably. I mean,
I lucked out. I lucked out. I found a group of really good friends, and I lucked out with my professors. I had teachers who, for some reason, invested in me and wanted to teach me and were patient with me. And when I would freak out or challenge them or be a jerk or whatever it was, they just breathed deeply and got me back on track and continued to help me even when I was most ungrateful. And now I'm very grateful for their attention and time and energy.
And while you were at Princeton, you achieved a great deal. You wrote two different senior theses, one in anthropology and one as part of the Princeton Program of Creative Writing. And Toni Morrison was your thesis advisor, I understand.
Yeah, she was.
When you went on to get your PhD in University of Michigan, by the time you'd finished your PhD, you'd already published two novels. That's a lot of busyness there.
Well, I was pretty busy. I mean, one way to look at it is that I wasn't having as much fun as other people. Or that I was. I was doing exactly what I wanted to do.
Wow.
And I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to explore my intellect. I wanted to have a critical engagement with the world around me, and my graduate studies provided that. And I was an artist, and I wanted to write, and I wanted to explore and broaden and enlarge the world through fiction. And so I was doing both, I guess. As miserable as I might have felt at the time, I was secretly, deep down, very happy.
There's one interview I read somewhere that you took a little time off to finish your PhD thesis and your second novel at the same time.
that's something rather stunning
to think about. So early on in your academic career, you really thought that being a writer, writing fiction, nonfiction, was what you really wanted to do. How you could make an impact in the world.
Yeah, well, I was actually on the fence about it. When I was leaving undergrad, I didn't really think that writing was necessarily anything I had to do or should do. I mean, writing fiction, that is. And it was Toni Morrison who always cut to the chase. And she was such a good teacher, and we had so much fun. And she was, it remains a big part of my life. And she's looked at me, and we're talking, sort of processing the end of our time together. And she said, you know, I'm going to tell you this once. I'm never going to ever tell you again. So you better listen up. And I said, okay. What is it? She said, you're supposed to write. It's what you should do. It's clear that this is what you should do. You're going to do other things at the same time. I did. You know, I was a book editor and a writer. I did many things while I wrote. I've always worked and written. I've never just written. I expect the same from you. Do something that feeds you.
Yeah.
And that you're passionate about, but don't ever stop writing. And that was a really strong endorsement of what I might be able to accomplish if I actually worked really hard. And it saw me through a lot of rejection. So her support and her help was fundamental.
You still call her Dr. Morrison, I understand.
I always refer to her as Professor Morrison.
Professor Morrison.
I do. She's still that to me.
Yeah. One of the critics talking about Prudence talks about it in terms of being a beautifully orchestrated in its movement through time. When you started this book, did you have a roadmap of where you wanted to go and what you wanted to do, or did this unfold to you as well as it has to the reader?
Well, the answer is, I'm always mealy-mouthed. I think the answer is yes and no. Always the answer is yes and no for me. But I knew exactly where it was going to end because I knew how things ended for Prudence.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's no surprise you learn in the first page and a half how things end for her. What you don't know is why.
Right.
So I knew where it was going to end. I knew where it was going to begin. And there was I had a lot of questions about the middle. And that evolved. And I was surprised by what I was writing as I hope the reader is surprised when they read it. But what I set out to write was something I'd never really tried to write before, which was a very tight, plot-driven, character-driven story. I've written lots of different kinds of novels and lots of different kinds of books. And for me, the pleasure of each project is trying something I've never done and that I'm not sure I can do.
Right.
And so with Prudence, I'd never done a real tightly plotted, character-driven story. I wasn't sure I could do it. I think as much as we like those things as readers, they're very hard to accomplish convincingly as a writer.
Right.
It's a lot easier to hide behind your prose and get all fancy and use all your great words and sort of, you know, lard each paragraph with awesome simile after awesome simile and to get all fancy because you can cover up structural and psychological deficiencies with fancy language. And so I tried to pare my language back to it was only as fancy as necessary. And the characters had to come first, and their desires, their agendas had to come first. And that was really hard. It's fun, though.
It's really intricately crafted. It's really
Thank you.
It's just such a pleasure to read because the revelations, I mean, you sort of accumulate your understanding of these characters as a reader. You accumulate it as you go along. And it's just
thank you so much.
So artfully done. It's just sort of breathtaking,
thank
actually.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's true.
It's so great to hear.
I'm sorry to say that, but it's true.
Don't be sorry. Say it again.
So the story opens in August 1942 at a place called the Pines, which used to be a fancy resort, which is now a family summer home to people from Chicago. And most of the main characters have some history with each other when the story begins.
Yeah.
But the one person who doesn't is Prudence, the title character.
Right.
And she just arrives there in time to be at the scene of a terrible, terrible accident, which drives the rest of the book. Could you talk a little bit about Prudence?
Yeah. Well, she has a real-life antecedent, you know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So a long time ago, and this has stuck around in my head for a very long time, I was probably in my early 20s, and I was really broke then, so the only books I could afford were books, remainder books. And I bought the biggest ones I could because you got more words for the dollar. I bought some big literary biography of Hemingway. I read Hemingway. I liked Hemingway. I wasn't a fan. Mm-hmm. I was a sort of an appreciator to an extent, but I wasn't a part of any kind of Hemingway cult. But anyway, I got this big literary biography and I read it. And somewhere in there, he says, he's quoted as saying, "The first woman I ever pleasured was an Ojibwe half-breed girl named Prudence Bolton."
Right.
And that's a direct quote. And of course, we have to be a little skeptical. I don't think Hemingway ever pleasured anybody other than himself. And even then, that's in doubt. But the biographer did some research and did some due diligence. And there was, in fact, a girl named Prudence Bolton who lived near Traverse, Michigan, around the time that the Hemingways vacationed there in the summers. Their paths crossed. And all he was able to find out about her was that she existed and that she and her lover committed suicide by drinking strychnine when she was 19 years old and she was pregnant.
Wow.
And it always struck me. It struck me then and it stayed with me that we have thousands and thousands of pages on Hemingway, but we had one sentence about her. And I wanted to know what her life was like. What did she care about? Where did she come from? Why did she commit suicide? And was that is that a depressing fact or is that an act of defiance? How could, is that an act of will or is it an act of desperation? Why would she do that? And with a baby in her belly.
Right.
You know, and to commit suicide in such a painful way.
Yes.
Strychnine is not an easy way to go.
Right.
It's excruciating. So I was always curious about her. And this book is in part in my attempt to illuminate her life and to try to imagine what the qualities of her existence were and how it mattered to her and to the people around her. So she's the central character and she's really an outlier in the beginning of the book. She sort of wanders into these people's lives and it's a very bad day when she shows up, not to spoil any surprises reader. It's a very bad day.
Yes.
Everything goes horribly awry. And everyone pays for the mistakes made that day for the rest of their lives. Some days are like that.
Hopefully not too many.
Hopefully not too many. Some days are.
As the reader goes along, he really collects the backstories of most of your main characters. Mm. And it's very artful how you do this. But one of the things that you achieve is you give the reader a real sense of what the lives of Ojibwe people might have been like mm-hmm. in the early years of this century up to the 1950s, 1960s, thinking of Felix, the caretaker, and Prudence herself. Can you speak a little bit about that? Was that one of the things you wanted to do,
Did
that just emerged as you worked?
No. I mean, it emerged, I hope, but by design and with purpose.
Yes.
A lot of times, you know, Native characters and Native people, you know, real Native people, you know, all of us, fictional and real, are not really understood as sort of living in time.
Right.
We're more or less understood as perpetual sufferers, and that's about it, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, in 1890, when the frontier officially closed, in the Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier hypothesis, right? Mm-hmm. And the American West was no longer, and it was settled, right?
Right.
At that point, the way people think about Indians is that, oh, well, then we just stopped really being anything other than just decrepit, put upon, traumatized, living on our reservations, far from the public eye, going about this business of suffering all the time. And that's all we do.
Right.
And that we aren't of the place and time that other Americans are of. And so I very much wanted to look at how something like the Second World War, or even in parts of the First World War, came in and included Native people, touched them, shaped them. They were responding to their times as much as anybody else, and with sort of as much success and difficulty as anybody else. And I was really trying to undo this sense of sort of Indians is divorced from time and place and context. In the village that my family's from, of Bena, Minnesota, during the 1940s, there was a German prisoner of war camp within sight of my mother's village.
Wow.
At the same time, most of the men of that village, including my grandfather and all his brothers, were overseas fighting.
Right.
In every branch of the military except for the Marines. So there were my grandfather and his brothers were in the Army, Navy, and Air Corps. Right. So the Indians were gone and the Germans were there in that little village, right? And that war, at least as regards my grandfather, his experience as an infantry rifleman in the 2nd Division, that shaped everything that came after.
Yes.
It was, by his own admission, a horrible experience.
Not too many people from there got to be behind the lines or in the rear guard. They tended to be in the front.
Yeah.
You did a tremendous amount of research about World War II.
Yeah, I did.
I mean, your section on one of the main characters, Frankie, and his experience as a bombardier is just, it's amazing.
Thank you.
It's very...
Yeah, I did a lot of reading. and wondering and imagining. To me, being a bombardier would be the most frightening thing possible. It is a job for which I am least suited. And I wanted to research what for me was that terror and that discomfort. But for Frankie, it's perfect.
Yes.
He loves it.
Just that
it
one
suits him.
That one little section where he describes how everybody else on the plane can't really see very much because they have these little tiny windows, but he is in this plexiglass bubble at the bottom of the plane, and he can see every detail of everything on the ground.
Yeah, he can see everything.
It's just, that's an amazing scene.
Oh my gosh, yeah, and I would never want to be him.
And I mean, you put us in that place.
Thank you.
And with that feeling, it was just like, wow.
Oh, thank you.
And so that's a...
It was fun to write about. I mean, I've been since I was a young kid something of a World War II buff, maybe because of my grandfather, because of my father as well, being a refugee, because of that war and the Germans. That war shaped so much of my family, from how my mother grew up with her father being a difficult man, mm-hmm. To me growing up with my father, who's, well, he's a difficult man too. And I say that with love, but it shaped so much in my own life that it always was this subject which captivated me.
That's quite amazing. Now, you come from that area, and this is the setting for your book.
Yeah.
How much did that inform it? I mean, you really bring out a sense of the place in this story.
How much does the place inform?
Yes.
Oh, very much so. The English have what we think of as manor novels,
mm-hmm. right?
These large estates where all the sorts of people mix and, from different classes and genders and expectations, and it's all very regulated. And we see these manor novels, whether they're by, Austen or James or sort of Green or Evelyn Waugh or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And something gets thrown in the mix and it gets all messed up and difficult, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's what we, Downton Abbey and et cetera,
right.
et cetera. These are still very appealing. America, we don't have anything we have no equivalent to the English manor, except maybe the resort, where you have different people coming together. You have a kind of culture of the place. You have an underclass. You have owners. You have mixing. You have all sorts of things. And so on one hand, while the flora and fauna, the geography of northern Minnesota very much informs this book and probably, a lot of most, if not all of my other books. The resort setting, the American manor, I guess.
Right.
Was not something I'd ever written about, but those were such an important part of the cultural landscape of northern Minnesota, but also Wisconsin, Michigan, other places like that, upstate New York.
Huh.
And they're antiques, they're gone. There isn't that sort of resort culture anymore.
I guess now the ultra-rich buy islands.
Buy islands and they have their own boats and fish finders, right. And they don't need guides and they don't need sort of cabin boys and they don't need, they don't need all that stuff.
The fish come pre-cleaned, I guess. I don't know.
They come pre-cleaned on the stringer, right.
In another interview, you were talking about your book about the reservations and you were talking about you were really trying to get to the point of not the deficit of the reservation, but the abundance of the reservation in terms of opportunity. And when you look at the character Felix as he goes about his daily life, his daily living, you really get a sense of the abundance of place and someone who's derived from that place. Was that something you were trying to do? Or?
Yeah, well, with Felix, you meet him in the beginning of the book, and I think for most readers, he will seem quite a bit like a stock character in a novel. And this is by design. I mean, he very much resembles the kind of quiet, stoic, enduring Indian man, who speaks and grunts, if at all.
Right.
And as the novel progresses, we learn and relearn and unlearn and see him by the end in a radically different light.
Yes.
He's not the person you think. He's got a rich emotional life. He's got a very crowded interior. He's not the harmless, sort of kind of dopey, stoic eternal guy. To some characters, he's absolutely frightening. Not a father figure.
No.
Not a figure of kindness and so on. And so, but yeah, his daily life, I mean, he's got many, many concerns and sort of a deep and a sort of abiding and very complicated relationship with his physical surroundings, which he manages really well. He's very good at that. I like him a lot as a character.
He's the reader's growing appreciation and understanding of his life as the novel progresses. It's one of the marvels of the book,
I think.
I think it's just really great. Would you like to read something from the book today?
Sure. I mean, I guess I could read from the beginning a little bit.
Sure, that'd be wonderful.
I mean, the beginning, usually beginning is the last thing I write, but actually in this case, it was the very first thing I wrote. So yeah, I'll read a little bit from there. This is from the prologue. Everyone remembers that day in August 1952 when the Jew arrived on the reservation. In later years, the Indians would sometimes wonder idly at the strange fact of his arrival and his departure on the first train to Minneapolis the next morning. But the Jew was forgotten that day, until then a day like any other, hot and muggy and filled mostly with the thrum of wind-plucked power lines and the crack of grasshoppers lifting out of the sand and spent grass. The Jew stepped off the train and into the thoughts of the villagers, and he exited the station and their minds just as quickly, because an hour or two after the train groaned to a stop, one of the hotel maids found Prudence's body in the room above the wigwam bar. And then there was that. Her poor young body arched and twisted and frozen in the August heat. And Prudence's baby, too, whom no one saw alive, not even Prudence, in its little cathedral of blood. And then there was that, too. Not long after the maid found her, the sheriff had come. After him, the coroner. Then Felix and Billy, separately. Soon everyone in the village, Indian and white and in between, had gathered outside the hotel and in front of the hardware store and the grocers, on the platform that served the depot and in the wigwam itself. Since the village didn't consist of more than those small stores and the 100 or so Indians and loggers whose houses clustered around the railroad tracks, the gathering didn't look like much. It was, as dramatic events go, quiet. There wasn't much fuss when her body was loaded onto a canvas stretcher, covered with a white sheet, and handed down the narrow stairs like a ham in paper. No one raised a fuss, even though she was 26, and pregnant, and alone, and now dead. It just wasn't that kind of village. And northern Minnesota wasn't that kind of place. Besides, it was 1952 and there was a war on. The world was much too big to worry itself about a dead Indian girl. No one wondered, really, what had happened or why, in the way people who aren't accustomed to being wondered about discover they dislike thinking about themselves. It was too hot, in any event, to do more than sit and shake one's head. No, it was much better not to think of Prudence at all.
That's wonderful.
Thanks. Yeah, that's the beginning.
Now I'm going to stand by for the audiobook.
Well, I didn't read the audiobook.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, they have professionals do that, which is probably just as well.
That was awfully good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, David, for coming by to KBOO today and talking to us. And thank you for this beautiful and haunting book. You've been listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. We've been talking to David Troyer about his new novel, Prudence, which is published by Riverhead Books, part of the Penguin Group. David, thank you again for coming by, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio invites you to our springtime open house and live in-studio performance of Mama C, Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m. Tour the KBOO studios and meet your community. Share refreshments and talk with other listeners, program hosts, volunteers, and KBOO staff. See how our communities intersect and work together to create this amazing community radio station. We'll also have a live performance by Mama C, an accomplished musician, poet, and MC, as well as a former Black Panther and political refugee who fled the U.S. in early 1970s for Tanzania. Again, that's Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m., an open house and live performance by Mama C at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, your community radio station, KBOO Portland. We look forward to seeing you.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the Worldbeat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio productions from this and many other independent